Armageddon. The four horsemen of the apocalypse. The wars of Gog and Magog. These are the ancient symbols by which the apocalyptics, those who predicted the inevitable end of human civilization, imaged that fiery holocaust. For in ancient times as today, there were visionaries and political analysts who believed that human nature was such, that man's greed and animality was of such magnitude, that human civilization could not survive, that there would be a certain, final, ineluctable end, and it was only a question of sooner or later. Now, I've heard echoes and re-echoes of these ancient apocalyptics in our own day. You've heard them too. The ghetto's got to blow. There's sure to be a long, hot summer. The administration is so committed in Vietnam that there's no out short of a major war with China. The bomb will drop. It's only a question of where, when. Now, I can understand the pessimism, the anxiety, the despair, the sense of personal impotence, which breeds this kind of fatalism, the dark edge of our language, because in part I share, as we all must share, a great feeling of malaise, of unease about the direction of our times. But I also understand the larger wisdom which insists that it is steadiness and not self-pity which is the virtue, and that fatalism is really nothing more than an easy excuse for inaction. Or as our young people would put it, that it's a glib way of copping out. Some of the most critical, vital responsibilities of the age. And so though I believe that we must look the future straight in the eye and not blink at what we see, the dangers that are written there, we must also look to see what are the practical ways by which a better future, a happier day, can be constructed. For all human problems are essentially manufactured problems, man-made. And being man-made, they are capable of human solution. And so I was pleased as I began to read the report of the National Advisory Committee on Civil Disorder, the so-called Riot Commission's report, that it began by looking the problem squarely, to face up to the unwelcome reality, the unwelcome possibilities, but it also emphasized that there is still a choice. We can avert the evil decree. Let me read you from its introduction. This is our basic conclusion. Our nation is moving towards two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. Reaction to last summer's disorders has quickened the movement and deepened the division. Discrimination and segregation have long permeated much of American life and now threaten the future of every American. This deepening racial division is not inevitable. The movement apart can be reversed. Choice is still possible. Our principal task is to define that choice and to press for a national resolution. Life, in short, is not a Greek tragedy, but a great challenge. And the issue before America today is not one of building shelters against the evil winds of the future, but in building the schools and the hospitals and the communities which can assure us of a future. The choice is still ours. But no one be mistaken as to the nature of that choice. For this commission does not speak of our choice to engage once a year or not to engage once in a year in a Sunday afternoon interracial tea. And it is not speaking even of the choice to list our house with Fair Housing Inc. or to welcome a Negro neighbor into our neighborhood. The choice that faces America today is one between a radical, fundamental, massive reorientation of our national policy and a radical, massive reorientation of our national resource and to continue the present policies. And if we continue the present policy, the conclusion of this commission is simple and straightforward. Our nation will split apart. Our cities will continue turbulent. There will be violence and there will be repression and there will be more violence and there will be chaos and confusion. And in brief, all that we hold to be most precious in our American way of life will be destroyed, ripped apart, shredded, and left in tatters. Now, as you'll recall, the President brought this National Commission into being at the end of last summer, after the riots in Newark, in Detroit, in Atlanta, many another American city, riots which took 83 lives, wounded some 2,000 Americans, destroyed millions of dollars of property. And this commission was asked to discover how this had come about and why it had come about, and to suggest ways in which American society could be made more peaceful and more just and future riots be avoided. Now, a similar commission appointed itself, as you recall, here in Cleveland the year before, after our violence in Huff. And you recall that the report of that grand jury was largely what we might say is a whitewash. The white community was washed clean. And there was a suspicion cast that there were agitators from the outside. It was all part of some nationwide conspiracy. No one spoke of the white responsibility for the ghetto, the white responsibility for Negro unemployment, the white responsibility for discrimination. One looked for the agitator, the delinquent, the criminal element, the conspirator, the communist. Well, this commission, too, was asked to discover, in President Johnson's mandate, to what extent, if any, there has been planning or organization in any of the riots. And after massive weighing of evidence and the taking of testimony, their conclusion was straightforward and was capsuled in three little lines. The urban disorders of the summer of 1967 were not caused by, nor were they the consequence of, any organized plan or conspiracy. So much for Mr. Seltzer. So much for the attempt here in Cleveland to look anywhere but where one must look. At the prejudice of the white community. The fact, as this report makes clear, that the ghetto is a white-created institution maintained by the white community for its own privilege and for its own benefit. When the President's commission was appointed, many of the radicals in the civil rights movement, many of our professional liberals, complained about the middle-of-the-road composition of its membership. There were no Stokely Carmichaels, there were no Rap Browns, there was not even Martin Luther King. But they need not have worried, because it was the very moderate quality of the men who were and women who were appointed to this commission, which allowed them to look at the problem in all of its aspects without preconception, and which gives to this challenging, traumatic document much of the punch, thrust which it bears with it. For this document says some bitter things to the American people. It tells us very simply that though we have believed that during the last 20 years we have made progress towards the solution of our racial crisis, we have in fact not even held our own. That the gap between the Negro community and the white community has widened. And it has widened not simply because there are Negro extremists who are agitating the masses, demanding black power, black authority, black control of the black neighborhoods, but because the social and economic pressures which impinge upon the Negro community have magnified themselves. The problems are greater. We have not taken measures commensurate with the crisis to meet it. Now, the Commission itself worried about the acceptance of these conclusions. It warned at the very beginning of the report that the average reaction to the kind of statement it was making was simply to bury it, to forget about it. What happened after the riots of 1967? Nothing much happened. That's the conclusion of the report. Nothing much happened. A committee was appointed here. A program was launched there, a modest, moderate program. There was some confusion. There was some realignment in the councils and the city halls of the country. But by and large, nothing fundamental happened. Except that there was a determined effort by the police departments and the National Guards of the United States to train themselves in riot control, develop new mob control weapons, various gases, mace, paralyzing liquids, and the like. And as the conclusion of its report, where one would normally expect commissioners to list boldly again its recommendations, their recommendations for the future, they turn instead to a bit of testimony given to them by Dr. Kenneth Clark, a sociologist, urban specialist from Columbia University. And their conclusion is, in a sense, their worry capsuled in this testimony. I read that report of the 1919 riot in Chicago, and it is as if I were reading the report of the investigating committee on the Harlem riot of 1935, the report of the investigating committee of the Harlem riot of 1943, the report of the McCone Commission on the Watts riots of 1966. I must again in candor say to you, members of this commission, it is a kind of Alice in Wonderland, with the same moving picture reshown over and over again, the same analysis, the same recommendations, and the same inaction. This was a presidential commission. Mr. Johnson empowered it, Mr. Johnson appointed it, Mr. Johnson received the report. Mr. Johnson has yet to comment on the report. The New York Times review of the news of the week concluded its summation of this 800-page report with this brief paragraph. There was no immediate response from the White House. Mr. Johnson departed for Texas without comment. Now why? Because this report, black on white, highlights a fundamental statement about American policy, American principle, which runs counter to everything that the White House, for all of its concern with human rights, the White House is prepared to acknowledge. For it says very simply, that even though this administration has devoted more money and secured more legislation for a great society, even though there have been civil rights legislation in each of the last Congresses, even though there have been all manner of local and national commissions and committees and programs and volunteer agencies, though schools have been built and clinics have been built and hospitals have been built and recreational areas have been built, it's all been too little. Though we spend $9 billion a year to rehabilitate and renew our human resource nationally, We need to spend not $9 billion, but perhaps $90 billion. All the money that we now spend, or shall I say waste in Vietnam, all the money that we now spend to race out into the emptiness of space, all the money that we now spend in military aid to the oligarchs and to the dictators who stand against communism around the world, all that money and much more. Now, the Commission put no price tag on its recommendations. But when you talk of compensatory year-round education for the child in an urban environment, when you talk of $6 million of subsidized, 6 million units of subsidized low-cost housing to be built in 5 years, when you talk of 2 million jobs to be found in 3 years, 1 million of which must be found in the public sector, you're talking of $40, $50, $60 billion a year to be spent every year for the next 10, for the next 20, for the next 30 years. You're talking, in brief, of a totally new configuration to our national economy. You're talking about very strict and narrow limits to our ability to police the world, to send our troops abroad. You're talking about restriction of the sophisticated armor, the purchase of new weapons. You're talking about a society which would, for the first time in history, invest more in its human resources than in its machinery. Invest more in education than in the army. Invest more in its own cities than in conquests and exploitation abroad. And this is difficult for any American, for any of us conditioned by the economies and the judgments and the moralities of the past. It's a difficult concept for any of us to accept. We thought that we could buy pieces of our cities cheaply. Mr. Johnson thought he could have guns and butter. His guns have done him pretty precious little good. And the butter has been cut thinner, thinner. And it'll be cut thinner again. Because with the escalation in Vietnam and the gold drain and the demands of the wealthy that their wealth be protected in its international, in the international marketplace, what will be the natural solution? To cut the so-called non-essentials of our budget. And what are the non-essentials? The budget of the Office of Economic Opportunities. The programs to train adult illiterates to read and to write. The programs to fund new schools in the urban areas, to provide the children of these schools with equipment and with supplies and with opportunity and even with a camping experience. This is what will be cut. Watch it in the days ahead. It'll be cut, and it has already been cut. The budget this year for the welfare of our poor, of our Negro poor, of our Puerto Rican poor, of our Mexican poor, was held at its previous year's level, but new programs were thrown into that $2 billion plus sum so that existing programs were pared. When you translate down that down to Cleveland, it means something of the order of this. There are 7,000 four-year-olds in Cleveland, in the center city, who qualify for Operation Head Start, to be allowed the opportunity that all our children are allowed to have a nursery school experience. Up to this year, we've been able to provide 3,500 of these children, one in two, with this opportunity. This year, instead of providing all 7,000 that opportunity, we will provide only 2,000, or two in seven. The nursery school experience. Now, Americans are decent people. And many of us have been comforted in the last years as we've looked about Cleveland, that progress was being made. We saw the Huff Norwood Comprehensive Medical Clinic. We saw new schools in the center area. We saw a small constriction in the dropout rate from the Cleveland public schools. We saw libraries being built in the public schools. We heard that there was money now so that a child could go to a dentist and have his teeth looked after, and that if he was on welfare, parents were on welfare, the state would pay for the funds. We know that there are now pocket parks, recreational areas here and there in the city. We've heard of the Leak Park Center. We know that more and more money is going into various rehabilitation agencies. There has been Operation Head Start and Operation Outreach and all kinds of neighborhood centers. And we felt that things were on the way to being solved. But this report, this massive, deliberate, moderate report, says to us very briefly, very succinctly, nothing's being solved. The gap between the Negro and the white, between the rich and the poor, is widened. In 1947, and I speak now in constant dollars, the difference between the income of the median Negro family and the median white family was $2,100. In 1967, the difference in income between the median Negro family and the median white family is $3,100. Oh, we've seen Negroes move into Shaker Heights, a few into Cleveland Heights, a few into Beechwood. We thought that integration was on its way. In 1947, the suburbs around our center cities were 95% white. In 1967, they're 96% white. Is that progress? In 1947, our center city still had a balance between the Negro population and their white population. Today, because of the white exodus, they are, in many cases, preponderantly Negro. The Negro is in the center. In that community which has the largest human need, the largest welfare cost, the largest educational cost, the greatest educational challenge, and the least ability to pay the freight. Because the wealth has moved away. The wealth is abandoned. Yes, we have reduced maternal death dramatically between 1947 and 1967. But interestingly, the rate of deaths among mothers per 100,000 birth has increased from a Negro-white relationship of 2-to-1 to a Negro-white relationship of 4-to-1. Four Negro mothers die for every one white. And this says volumes about the quality of medical care being received day in and day out by the Negro community. The gap between the poor and the middle class, between the Negro and the white, has widened. Why? Because of our discrimination, because our insistence on segregation in education, in employment, in housing, because of our emigration and their in-migration, so that the Negro, especially the impoverished Negro, is concentrated in the core city, which has the least political power. Because the pathology of the slum begins to operate there and demand greater and greater sums of money in order to be solved, to be cured, and in response we give it less and less. For every dollar spent on a child in the suburbs, we spend 50 cents on the child in the city. Now, education has improved over the last 20 years in Cleveland and elsewhere in the center city schools. But interestingly, 20 years ago, there was a differential by grade level of about 2 grades between the Negro child and the white child. The Negro child was perhaps doing a year's work less than his grade level, the white child a year's work better than his grade level. Today, the differential is not 2 years, but 3. And there is no statistical basis for believing that as yet, for all of our massive infusions of funds, I take it back, for all of our timid infusions of funds into the center city schools, that there has been any perceptible rise in the level of accomplishment by the Negro student. The only testing which has spoken of a rise in their levels of achievement is testing which have been done on Negroes who have been bussed out of their neighborhoods, transported into the suburbs. They're allowed to mix and to mingle and to be educated with children from environments other than their own. I spoke 10 days ago at Shaker Heights High School at their honors assembly. About 75 or 80 young people were being honored for academic accomplishment in the high school. There were only two Negroes among the group honored. And I asked the principal why. He said that these two come from the Negro children who have been in the Shaker Heights school system since kindergarten. And when the children come into the school in the third grade or the sixth grade or the ninth grade, it's already too late to train them to work, to give them the background which will allow them to compete with the best of the white children who have had this opportunity from the very beginning. The gap widened. We've retrogressed, not progressed. Now, I do not mean to say that many have not been selfless, that there has been no tutoring, that there has been no building, that you haven't paid higher taxes. You have, and I have. But I mean to say that if we are seriously concerned with solving the crisis of our cities, it's human crisis. Then we must talk of monies, of taxes, of programs on a sweep and a scale most of us have not yet even begun to imagine. We've got to begin to talk, as this report insists, not of a welfare program which might possibly this year, if Cleveland manages to pass a $3 million welfare levy, which might allow the person on welfare to receive 83 cents on every dollar that she needs or he needs to provide for his family basic subsistence based on what was needed in 1959. We might somehow raise it from 83 cents to 90 cents, to 9 meals out of 10. We're talking about a new concept of welfare which will guarantee to every American a minimum annual income. We're talking not of a few public housing high-rise apartments which are geared primarily for the elderly, but of moderate and low-income subsidized housing for the poor, the families with many children. We're talking of an economy which will not insist that the father must abandon the family in order for his family to qualify for welfare. We're talking of an economy which will subsidize employment for the badly trained and the inadequately trained, which will constantly remind itself that Negro unemployment is 4 times white unemployment, and that Negro underemployment is 8.8 times white employment. And we'll not take much pride in the accomplishment of our schools, because even those who've managed to graduate, not the dropouts, but those who managed to graduate from our East Side high schools in Cleveland, have a 1 in 2 chance of still being unemployed 6 months after their graduation. We're going to talk of massive urban renewal, but not the kind of urban renewal which empties out the low-income apartments in order to build advantaged apartments or institutions for the wealthy. But we're going to talk about building low-income housing for those who need low-income housing, and to build it not only in Hough or in Glenville, but in Mount Pleasant, in Cleveland Heights, Shaker Heights, Pepper Pike, and even Chagrin Falls. We're going to talk about a community which is not divided against itself, the wealthy here, the poor here, the black here, the white across the river over here. We're going to talk of a community which shares a sense of responsibility, shares its tax dollars, sees that there is compensatory education, adequate medical care, adequate opportunity. It takes $10,000 a year to provide job retraining for a single youngster at one of our job corps centers. Imagine if we took this $10,000 and we spread it over the 12 years of that child's education. We might be able to provide him some decency in education. Today we provide $400 per child per year. Today we put that Center City child in a class with 39 to 41 others. Our own children in the suburbs are in classes with 20 to 24 others. He needs a class not of 20 or 24, but of 4, and sometimes even of 2. He needs to have all the disadvantage of his background erased. He needs to have all the pathology of the ghetto reoriented for him. He needs to be brought out of his environment into a new opportunity, and sometimes that can be done only by continuous one-to-one contact. All this must be done, and all this will cost money. And if we continue to believe that America can have an integrated society, that we can solve the human crisis of our cities, then let us be honest about it. It will mean an end to a great deal of the superabundance of the privileged. It will mean much higher taxes. It will mean major reorientation of our national policies abroad. It will mean restriction of the space program. It will mean a concentration on human programs. And it's a decision which must be taken now. Not tomorrow. Not a year from now. Now, because every year we waste, every year we spending only what we now spend, every year we live in our suburban comfort, forgetting about the discomfort of the city, is another year in which other children have grown into delinquent adolescents. There's another year in which thousands and tens of thousands of children have had inadequate education. It's another year in which the slum has been a place of violence and of anger and of bitterness and of frustration. It's another year of violence and counter-violence, of backlash and front-lash, of innocent people killed, maimed, and of cities which are slowly losing their attractiveness to all of us as places in which to live. I began by speaking of the apocalyptics. There's only one apocalyptic book in the Bible, the book of Daniel. And in one of the visions about the end of the world in the book of Daniel, the prophet prophesies that it will come a dan ve danim flagidan, in time, times, and half a time. Now no one has ever known what this prophecy means, because it's implicit within it that time is not a fixed measure. There are not 60 seconds in every minute and 60 minutes in every hour and 24 hours in every day. There are some minutes which have 120 seconds. There are some days which are endless. And there are some minutes which have only 1 second. And some days which have only 1 hour. There's some time which is apocopated, abbreviated, cut short, where you have to accomplish a great deal in very short compass. And I submit to you that we live in such a day. It's not an easy day in which to live. It's a tremendously challenging time. But here it is. Here's the responsibility. Guns. Schools. Spaceships. Hospitals. Concern with the quality of life in the center of our city. Or a concern with the little atomic structure which is at the center of a plutonium bomb. Which will it be? We can't continue as we now are. But what will we have gained? If we bear our bayonets, bring peace to the streets of Saigon, and have to bring bayonets into the streets of Cleveland in order to bring peace. What will we have gained if we put a man onto the moon? But we can't put a woman into a classroom in Huff because she's afraid to go to that classroom. What will we have gained? For all the miracles of modern medicine, if the poor cannot avail themselves of that healing, what will we have gained if we will have turned our police into a riot control outfit, from friends into foes? What will we have gained if we will have polarized our society from black and white, poor and rich, young and not so young. We split apart, this great dream we all share, this dream which is called America. I commend to you the report of the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorder. It's hard reading, it's compact, terse for all of its length. Read it with an open mind, because what it says requires an open mind. What it says requires we accept a new society, a new order of priority, a new order of urgency. The commissioners brought out this report 4 months before the target date set for it because they felt that it was so urgent that it must be said now. The president left for his ranch without comment. They brought out this report 4 months early because they felt that Congress would be in session, that now was the opportunity to bring into being new massive federal legislation for federal aid to education, for low costs of vetted housing, for 2 million jobs, a million of them on the federal payroll, for new insurance regulations so that people can continue to live in the center of the city, for all manner of restructuring and refinancing of our police so that there'll be an elite force and not a force drawn out of those who have barely escaped from the ghetto. And what has been our response? To watch the gold rush, to argue that that the president must not impose upon us a surcharge of 10% on our tax until he has cut away the non-essentials. And what do we define as non-essential? All I submit that is quintessential. All that is basic to the survival of American life. Yes, it's an Alice in Wonderland world we live in. Here's the priority. Here's the place we live. Here's the blueprint for it, for its tomorrow. Here, way out there, are today's policies. Irrelevant, many of them. Self-defeating, some of them, visionary in an engineering sense, many of them, but essentially on another planet, and this is our planet, essentially of the 19th century, and this is the 20th century, essentially about somebody else, yet this is our nation. Here we are. I pray that the commission's feeling that its report will be read, filed, will not be its fate. I fear that it will be. The only hope that I see is that there is a groundswell of demand from the electorate that our national legislators rise above their narrow horizons, plunge ahead to solve the problems of the city, of race. We have had a lot of talk about the backlash. I think it's about time that each of us realize that we who sit to do nothing are also part of the backlash. We're part of the great inert mass, and this nation cannot afford inertness. We need a new vision. We need a new kind of citizen. We need a united dedication to human values. We need an acceptance of a totally new philosophy of national purpose. That's what the commission's report says. That's what those who have studied the problems of our cities are saying. It's up to us now to make it effective. I pray to God we will.